Chapter 31. Madagascar, Indian Ocean. Their entry was thankfully short. After 5 feet of hunched walking, they saw that the rock ceiling abruptly sloped upward and found themselves standing in an elongated oval cavern 100 feet wide, with a 30-foot-tall stalactite-riddled ceiling. Their headlamps weren't strong enough to penetrate more than 30 feet ahead, but from what they could see, the space appeared to be loosely divided into rooms by mineral columns that shone pearlescent gray and butter yellow in the beams of their lamps. The quartz occlusions in the walls winked and sparkled. The floor, a mixture of jagged rock and silt that crunched under their boots, was split by a narrow, winding creek. "Seems like a natural place to start," Sam said, and Remy nodded. Using the creek's path as a guide, they began moving into the cave. "Somewhat anticlimactic," Remy said after a few minutes. "I know. The day is young, though." Their last spelunking adventure had ended with not only the solution of the mystery of Napoleon's lost cellar, but also a discovery that was helping rewrite parts of ancient Greek history. They continued on, covering 100 feet, then 200. Sam's headlamp picked out a wedge-shaped wall ahead from whose base the creek gushed. On either side of the wall, a tunnel curved back into darkness. "Your pick," Sam said. "Left or right?" "Right." They hopped over the creek and started down the right-hand tunnel. After 20 feet, the floor sloped down and they found themselves standing in calf-deep water. Sam shined his beam over the surface. There was a slight eddying current. They kept walking. Remy stopped and put her index finger to her lips. She clicked off her headlamp. Sam did the same. Then, following 10 seconds of silence, a sound. Something moving in the darkness ahead, like leather scraping against stone. More silence, then another sound, like a heavy wet towel striking rock. Sam and Remy looked at each other and in near unison mouthed, "Crocodile." The leather was scaled skin rubbing on rock, the wet towel a heavily muscled tail slapping stone. Splashing. Heavy feet plodded through water. Sam drew the Webley and pointed it into the darkness. Together, he and Remy clicked on their headlamps. 20 feet away and sloshing directly toward them was a crocodile snout. Just behind the snout, a pair of heavy-lidded eyes staring back at them. Farther back, at the edge of their headlamp beams, they could see a half-dozen scaly bodies writhing about, eyes flashing, mouths agape, tails whipping. "Flare," Sam said. Remy didn't hesitate. With a hiss, the tunnel filled with flickering red light. Remy lowered the flare to knee level and waved it before the oncoming crocodile, which stopped, opened its mouth, and let out a low hiss. "The kid was right," she said. "They don't care for it." "For now. Start backing up. Slowly. Don't turn your back on it." In lockstep, with Remy's eyes fixed on the approaching crocodile, they began retreating. Sam glanced over his shoulder. "Another 10 steps and we're at the ramp, then the narrow part."
"Okay."
"When we get there, plant the flare in the sand. We'll see how they like that." When they reached the spot, Sam patted Remy's shoulder. She knelt down, jammed the flare into the silt, then stood up and kept backstepping, with Sam's hand still on her shoulder. Halfway up the ramp, the crocodile stopped 6 feet before the hissing flare. It scrabbled first to the left, then to the right, then stopped again. It let out another hiss, then back down the ramp and into the water. After a few seconds, it disappeared from view. "How long do flares last?" Remy asked.
"That kind?
10 or 15 minutes. With luck, long enough for us to check the other tunnel."
"And if not?"
"Then we get to see how good I am with the Webley." Pausing to listen every 10 paces or so, they proceeded down the left-hand tunnel. After 40 feet, the tunnel suddenly broadened out into a roughly circular chamber. Remy's headlamp swept over a dark, elongated object on the floor. They both started and backpedaled 10 steps, their feet skidding in the sand. Remy whispered. Was it? I don't think so. He took a deep breath and let it out. Enough to get my heart going, though. Come on. They moved forward until their beams again found the object.
Looks like a rotted telephone pole, Remy said.
And it did. But almost immediately Sam noticed what looked like a trio of wooden cross braces affixed to the pole, then bindings of some kind, mostly crumbled to dust but intact enough to retain their basic shape.
It's an outrigger, Remy whispered.
Sam nodded and kept panning his headlamp along the cross braces to a point where they merged with an elongated heap of partially rotten wood, this one a few feet longer than the telephone pole, and 4 to 5 times its diameter.
Sam, that's a canoe.
He nodded. A big one. At least 30 feet long. Together they sidestepped around the craft to the other side, where they found a corresponding cross-brace outrigger set up. The body of the canoe was 5 feet wide and 4 feet tall from keel to gunwale, with a tapered bow and jutting bowsprit and a squared-off stern. At midships, rising 8 feet from the hull, was what looked like a shattered mast. The upper part, about 10 feet long, lay on the ground, its end propped up on the gunwale. Ahead of the mast, the hull was topped by a shallow, double-pitch roof.
Sam, step back, Remy whispered.
He followed her back a few paces. She pointed at the ground beneath the vessel. What they'd taken for simply a high point in the floor was in fact a 2-foot-high platform constructed of carefully placed stones.
This is an altar, he said.
After a quick check on their anti-croc flare, which had burned down to the halfway mark, they got busy examining the outrigger, Remy taking in-situ pictures for scale and design before moving in for close-ups. Using the tip of his Swiss Army knife, Sam took trace samples of the wood and the bindings. Everything's coated in some kind of resin, he told Remy, sniffing the material. It's thick. At least an inch.
That would explain its remarkable condition, she replied.
Sam stepped over the starboard side outrigger, walked to the gunwale, and peered inside the craft. Lying around the base of the mast was a mound of what he could only describe as decomposed canvas. Mottled brown and gray, the material had partially congealed into a gelatinous mass.
Remy, you need to see this.
She joined him at the gunwale.
Big sail, she said, and began taking pictures.
Sam unsheathed his machete and, with Remy hanging onto his belt lest he fall in, leaned forward and gingerly slid the blade into the pile.
It's like onion skin, he muttered.
He lifted free a tattered section of the material. Remy was ready with an empty Ziploc bag. As he slid the sample inside, it broke into 3 sections. Remy sealed the bag and walked back to her pack to deposit it with the other samples. Sam stepped around to the stern. Jutting from the transom was a bulbous wooden object, like a gnarled football leaning forward on a kickoff tee. Like almost everything else about the outrigger, it took Sam several seconds and several tilts of his head before he finally realized what he was seeing. Remy came up behind him.
Our mystery bird, she said.
Sam nodded. From the Orizaga Codex and Blaylock's journal.
What did he call it?
The great green-jeweled bird? Remy mused. Though I don't think this is what he was talking about. She took 12 pictures of the carving with her digital camera.
Let's check the bowsprit, said Sam.
When it comes to boats, these kinds of things often come in pairs. They walked to the bow. As Sam had guessed, the bowsprit also bore a carving, this one in better condition than its counterpart. In fact, the bowsprit itself was the sculpture. A serpent, its mouth agape, feathered plumes streaming backward from its head.
Sam, do you know what this resembles? Remy asked.
No. Should I?
Probably not, I suppose.
It's less elaborate and stylized, but it's the near-spitting image of Quetzalcoatl, the great plumed serpent god of the Aztecs.
Crazy like a fox, Sam muttered after a few seconds.
Pardon?
Blaylock. Crazy like a fox. Clearly, he hid the Marone map and the Codex together in his walking staff for good reason. He was obsessed with something, all right, but it was about more than the Shenandoah or the El Majidi. Maybe it started out with them, Remy agreed. But somewhere along the line he must have found something, or learned something, that changed his focus. The question is, how did whoever brought this canoe here get it in the cave? Unless there's another entrance beyond Crocoville down there, they must have dismantled it, brought it in through the waterfall, then reassembled it. That's a lot of work. We're 2 miles from the beach, and it weighs a couple thousand pounds. Sailors tend to get attached to their vessel, especially if it's seen them through rough seas and a long voyage. We might know more once we get these samples tested, but if we're buying into Blaylock's Odyssey, this could be an Aztec boat. Which would make it what? At least 600 years old? We're talking about rewriting history, Sam. There are no accounts of the Aztecs traveling beyond Mexico's coastal regions, let alone across the Pacific and around the Cape of Good Hope. We're thinking at cross purposes, my dear. How so? You're thinking west to east in the 16th century. I'm thinking east to west and much earlier than that. You can't be serious. Remy, you said it yourself. Historians aren't entirely sure where the Aztecs originated. What if we're standing in front of a proto-Aztec migration ship?